It's little wonder people sometimes want to live in simpler times. Ours are getting more and more complex by the decade, sometimes it seems by the minute. One example, ethics and moral decision-making relative to medicine, medical experimentation and research, and healthcare issues. I'm Susan McInnes. Join me on Conversations while we talk today with Dr. David Smith about medical ethics at the end of the 20th century. Dr. Smith joins us from Indiana University, where he is a professor of religious studies. He is also the director of the Poynter Center for Ethics and American Institutions. We'll talk today in general about the changing scene in terms of medical ethics. I want to start, though, with a framework. This nation is seen from outside, certainly, as a religious nation. And certainly many people inside this country see it as a religious nation. Many people identify with religious groups. Many people say they go to church every week. How does that, I suppose is a question, inform our moral decision making in this country? Do you think it does?
Oh, I think it certainly does, practically speaking. I think, in fact, most people, when they come to make moral decisions, fall back on a set of values, a set of traditions, a perspective on the world that they, as we would say, took in with their mother's milk. And I think, in fact, people's judgments are formed that way, and I think that's all well and good. Certainly mine are. I mean, I'm no exception to that generalization. I do think that we need, as a culture, to fully to grasp the pluralism of our society, the fact that increasingly our country includes persons who come from traditions that disagree with each other, that where people don't say the same thing, where consensus can't be assumed. And we need practice at reasoning and talking and thinking together with people who, as we would say, aren't coming from the same place we are.
One of the reasons we tend to be fairly contentious at this time as a society.
I suppose. I think there's been a real breakdown in our traditions and practices and habits of argument about fundamental issues. We're very good at shouting at each other or arguing by raising our voice tone and shrieking, and not very good and not very practiced at sitting down with persons with whom we disagree and trying to work something out. I think that's the fact that we aren't very good at that suggests a limitation of our educational institutions, our religious institutions, maybe some community service organizations. Groups like the University of Alaska or the Presbyterian Church or the Native American community or the Rotary should be places in which people learn and practice having serious discussion with people with whom they disagree. I think we run away from that, as a matter of fact. I think we tend to just say, well, that's all right for you and this is all right for me, and leave it at that, and not face up to the fact that as a group we've got to make some decisions.
And that desire to run away, or that actually running away, is limiting our ability to make the complex decisions or come to grips with the complex issues we see.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I also think that it's, I'm a professor. I mean, I suppose it's predictable that I'm going to say that one part of the solution to these kinds of problems lies with our educational institutions. I think we've gotten into the habit of providing people with a much better technical education than we do providing people with a sense of vision, a sense of order, a sense of priorities among values. And I, for one, would like to see universities and colleges getting back further into the business of helping people think about ethical questions.
And does this call for more cross-disciplinary study?
I tend to think that it does. I don't think that cross-disciplinary study is an end in itself. I don't think it's some sort of panacea that will solve all problems. I do think that the study of ethics and values enormously benefits from cross-disciplinary study. One of the reasons is because the value and ethical questions we face now are so terribly complicated. But there's another reason, and that is that when you're forced to deal with professionals or pre-professionals who are in a different line of work than you are, they call in question your fundamental assumptions. People are training to be TV cameramen. People are training to be lawyers, buy into a set of assumptions about those lines of work. If they're forced to argue with somebody who's training to be a doctor, or training to be a journalist, or training to be a professor of religion, for heaven's sake, they're forced to push to the more foundational assumptions of their disciplines or careers or lines of work. I think that's very healthy.
We're talking today with Dr. David Smith. Dr. Smith was educated at Carleton College in philosophy. He graduated from there in 1961. From Yale Divinity School with a bachelor's in divinity in 1964, and he took his doctorate from Princeton in 1967. Once again, he's teaching at the University of Indiana at Bloomington, where he is a professor of religious studies, also director of the Poynter Center. We'll introduce the Poynter Center a little more as we move along. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I said at the outset, and it feels that you have agreed with me, that moral and ethical decision-making issues relative to medicine have gotten vastly more complex in the last several decades.
Yes.
Are there a couple of easy illustrations that people can kind of grab onto for the sake of this discussion?
Sure. The core fact is that we've got more power. And because we've got more power, there are more options for choice available to us. Let me just take two quick ones. One, at the end of life, we now can keep people alive much longer than human beings ever could before, often keeping people alive in circumstances that, to an outsider at least, don't look very good. Dying is nothing new. I mean, death is nothing new. I mean, people have always died, so far as we know. But the circumstances of dying, thanks to the power we've achieved, and I celebrate that power, but the circumstances of dying have radically changed. Just in my own lifetime. It used to be the case that most people died of accidents or infectious disease, that they died relatively young, and they died fast. They also died at home.
Yes.
Today, those of us who are taking part in this conversation know that we and our loved ones can expect to die old. We can expect to die after an extended period of degeneration and decline. We can expect to die alone, and we can expect to die in an institution. That doesn't look like an improvement. So that we as a culture face the following situation. We've done a lot to delay death, but paradoxically, in the same process, it looks like we've made dying worse. And raises very complicated issues. Are there times when someone would be better off dead? Are there times we should help someone to die? It's not perversity that makes people raise those questions. It's a function of the kinds of power we've got. I think you can see the same kind of thing at the beginning of life. It used to be people got married, or maybe apart from marriage, made love, and the result was a baby, or it wasn't. And that was just about all that could be said. We now know so much more about genetics, about the possible and likely problems one of our children will have, and the amount we know about that is teeny compared to what we're likely to have in 10, 15, or 20 years, so that couples are very likely to have the possibility, I don't mean they should use this, but to decide not just whether they want sons or daughters, whether they want blondes or brunettes, whether they want short ones or tall ones, et cetera. Moreover, we can now do a tremendous number of things to assist people in reproduction. Everybody's heard or read about surrogate mothering, about in vitro fertilization, with fertilized embryos preserved in freezers. There's just many more options and choices available for people. That creates complexity, creates ambiguity, creates uncertainty. It's scary.
And we're reacting to it by being scared, generally,
sure.
Are we not?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's hard not to be scared. On the whole, my view is we ought to approach these possibilities in a spirit of confidence, that we ought to celebrate the great things that we can now do to help each other out. But we shouldn't let ourselves get into the position of saying that we should do everything we can do. I mean, I think there are some times when the technology shouldn't be used people shouldn't be kept alive, or perhaps when children shouldn't be conceived, or knowledge about what a child will be like should not be discovered. I think it's important to be willing to maintain a little mystery or uncertainty in life. The entirely known life is not necessarily the best life at all.
I also wonder whether issues around quality of life are not going to become increasingly important. When you describe, as you just have, the end of life and how it has transformed in the last 20 and 30
yes.
years, and the beginning of life and how it is going to be transforming in the next 10 to 20 years, is not quality of life something we're going to have to really chew on?
Oh, well, I think so. My own teacher and one side of me is very uncomfortable with that. I don't like the idea of sort of saying, well, one life is better than another. Mm. One kind of life is worth living, another kind of life isn't worth living. I think maybe for a lot of us who are in our 50s or maybe in their 40s and older, that just, you immediately think of racial injustice and of the Nazi state, in both of which cases, certain human beings were said to have lives not worth living, or inferior kinds of lives. I'm very troubled by that. I find that uncomfortable. I would rather try to talk about a natural lifespan in which there comes a time to die, which we acknowledge, or a time at which we at least say, well, we're not going to keep pumping endless resources into somebody else. That at least has the virtue of not being elitist. On the other hand, I think it's right that we just have to talk about the quality of life issues. I think they're there, and we can't put our heads in the sand about them.
We should acknowledge at this point that Dr. David Smith is struggling with quality of life as we speak today. He's come to us with quite a cold, very kind to be talking to us under hampered circumstances. Thank you very much, actually, for submitting to this. Dr. David Smith has written extensively on the subject of ethics, medical ethics, teaching ethics, ethics and business, ethics and private people. Among his five books include Health and Medicine in the Anglican Tradition, Conscience, Community, and Compromise. It came out in 1986, and a book called Respect and Care in Medical Ethics, of which he was the editor. That book emerged in 1984. A great number of publications will allude to those as we go along. I'm Susan McGinnis. This, again, is Conversations. You mentioned, and one of your purposes in being here is to talk about a subject that does relate to Nazi experimentation.
Yes.
So we may as well raise this. The subject of your lecture is titled Tainted Products.
Yes.
And I think it might be important just to indicate what a tainted product is in general here.
Well, I think of a tainted product as something that we get. What we get can be knowledge, it can be tissue, it can be a body, it can be something we get, whatever we get as a result of an immoral choice or action. So the data that the Nazis got from studying, from subjecting Jews, Poles, Gypsies, and others to terrible experimentation procedures without their consent, those data are, from my point of view, a tainted product. Mm-hmm. That's to say, they're tainted or infected because of the way they were obtained.
A gentleman named Robert Pozzo, in very recent times, he's a physiologist in Minnesota, is concerned, as a Minnesotan physiologist may well be, with
yes.
the issue of hypothermia.
Yes.
He discovered information that has not exactly been hidden, but has kind of emerged into scientific data and then slipped away since the 40s. He discovered information based on Nazi experimentation that he felt was fairly sound on the subject of hypothermia, and then began to struggle terribly with himself about whether this information should be explored. And the struggle went beyond Robert Pozzo. Can you set the stage a bit? What did the Nazis do, and why is this information potentially useful and potentially dreadful to have around?
Okay. basically what they did was put people into very cold water, just over the freezing point, and left them in the water for a long time, then brought them out, and their objective was to determine whether rapid thawing or slow thawing was the best. The orthodoxy at that time in the early 40s was that the best strategy was to do slow thawing. And what the Nazis discovered is, in fact, rapid thawing is much better. They wanted to do it because of the Battle of Britain, and their planes were being shot down in the North Sea, pilots were being dropped into very cold water, and they wanted to figure out what's the best thing to do for these men once they were fished out, if they were. Now, so far as I can tell, this information can only be used for good purposes. The trouble is the price that was paid for it.
Yeah.
I mean, people were people who had already been insulted, unjustly treated, captured, and humiliated were then thrown into this ice water, and people watched to see how they'd react. I mean, it's kind of a paradigm of unjust and inhumane treatment of one person by another.
There are choices about how we approach this information. One is lock it away and never look at it.
Yes.
And there is kind of a moral grid that looks at it in that way, is there not?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think you can, one very natural response to this situation is to say, well, that's just so terrible that we're not going to use this information no matter what.
We must keep ourselves away from it.
That's right. We must keep our distance from it. Even if it's not our fault in any significant way, still, the association is so strong that I don't want to associate with the data because I'll be polluted by that association. I think that's a very powerful and understandable response. Ultimately, however, it's not where I am.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that a life lived in trying to shun everything that's evil, in trying to maintain my purity by distancing myself from everything that's evil, is an impossible kind of life. I am more into acceptance of the ambiguity of the world, and therefore I tend to think that these data should be used. I would like them used with a certain set of safeguards, that's not very well said. What I mean is, I'd like them used with some sort of acknowledgement that of their origins. That might be a footnote, might be a black border printed around the page. I don't know what. I'm not an expert on that. But I don't want the world to forget where those data came from. Now, at the risk of destroying my own point, because I'm honored to be on this tape, I'd better enter into the record the fact that it's in no way clear that the Nazi data are reliable scientifically. At least one very powerful article has been published in which the author, a physician named Berger, argues that just as science set aside everything else, there were no controls, the measurements were not done adequately, etc., etc. So that just as science, the data are inadequate.
I wonder if giving Robert Pozzo and other physiologists, other scientists interested in this subject, an opportunity to look at it, study it, and like Dr. Berger rejected, or perhaps Pozzo will accept it, if that doesn't give us a chance to bring the dreadfulness of that time period forward again as an object lesson generally. It's sort of your black border comment, only
yes.
Larger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that talking about a serious abuse or problem has a wonderful educational effect in the population. I just at the risk of bringing in something from left field, I do think that the Senate confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas, whatever else we might say about them, and there's a lot else we could say about them, but I do suspect that around the country, perhaps around the world, there were more serious discussions of sexual harassment than have been had maybe ever. And I think that in itself is probably a very good thing.
It dragged it all forward, dragged it all out.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of households in which spouses or partners didn't speak to each other for a while, and which different perceptions were shared. I think in that sense, bringing an issue, if you will, out of the closet is an extremely healthy thing for the culture.
And do we then, whether we're talking about Nazi experimentation or whether we're talking about an incredible hearing process, then we expose more about ourselves as well as more about what may be happening 10 years ago or maybe happening 50 years ago in a culture?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the moral discussion, I do apologize for my voice, I think the moral discussion is unhealthy if it doesn't involve a certain element of self-discovery and self-disclosure. It's very cheap moralism to say, oh, look at those awful Nazis, or look at that terrible office where things were going on, or look at that liar, or whatever people are going to say. I think if the moral discussion is going to be at all honest, it's got to include a self-reflective element. When might I do something vaguely analogous? When was I insensitive? When did I trim the truth? I mean, the persons who don't see themselves as subject to and judged by their own moral statements always struck me as being a little disingenuous.
Another argument for bringing these things up as frequently as possible. In our own time, we have not been, in this nation, immune to what we would think of in 1991, 92 as immoral experimentation. The one example I know that sticks most solidly in the craw was experiments done at the research rather done at the Tuskegee Institute.
Yes,
they're about around the issue of syphilis.
Yes, that's right. There was this is as they say, a cause celebre. Starting in the 20s, a group of black men were offered a treatment that it was thought might have a chance of affecting syphilis. At the beginning, it looked like there was a possibility this was a reasonable treatment, and the idea was, we'll follow these men out in history and see what effect this particular treatment has. There may have been other problems at the beginning, but the place at which the experiment became extremely problematical was when penicillin was discovered to be a helpful treatment for tertiary syphilis. And it wasn't offered to these men. They just, researchers simply continued to follow their progress and treat them as subjects without offering them the best cure possible and without telling them that they were experimental subjects. The men thought they were being given an effective treatment. And that continued, I believe, until after the Second World War. I mean, there are other situations of experimentation in the United States that have caused that kind of a problem.
Was this instance the instance of scientists just wanting to stay with the therapy that they had prescribed to see how it worked?
Well, it...
Looking for a defense here.
Right. I think, they may have thought that not much could be done for these men anyway. There may have been... In fact, it certainly looks like there was a significant racial bias that contributing to the view that nothing could be done for them anyway.
They're only black men.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's a pretty disreputable episode in our history.
We would like to believe in this day and age that there are sufficient safeguards against that kind of research. At this time, would we be fooling ourselves if we thought so?
I don't know. There certainly are better safeguards. As a result of the Tuskegee syphilis study and a whole range of other real and perceived abuses, the United States has set up something called an investigational or institutional review board mechanism, and all experiments using a human subject must be approved by that IRB if they're federally funded, or I should say if the institution that does the experiment receives a federal funding.
Is the oversight sufficient from your perspective? I'm thinking about a nation that is a democracy. Can we sit back on this one and say the oversight is sufficient, no more Tuskegees?
Well, I do think there is a point where there has to be a matrix of trust with the scientific community. I think it's very hard for non-scientists to make detailed judgments about the morality of every particular experiment. But I do think in a democracy, it's particularly important that we be vigilant because in a democracy, we say not only that we've all got rights, we say we've got a responsibility for the kind of country we are, for the kind of people we are or want to be. And that notion of responsibility means that we shouldn't just let people get away with doing terrible things and shrugging it off. I mean, I think in a democracy we're saying the bad things somebody else does may to a certain degree be my fault. If there were things I could have done to prevent it, I've got a responsibility to do them.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Dr. David Smith. Dr. David Smith is the director of the Poynter Center for the Study of Ethics and American Institutions, also a full professor of religious studies at the University of Indiana. He's been with Indiana since 1967, with the exception of a short break at Georgetown University
Yes.
in 73-74. He's also a seminar director of a subject called Liberal Education and Moral Criticism at Indiana University. This is Conversations, and I'm Susan McGinnis. Are the special responsibilities in a democracy greater than responsibilities in a socialist country, or a communist country, or a monarchy? Or I mean, is it a special?
I tend to think that they are, Susan. I work on with very homey analogies. I remember when our children were small and we would take a trip and there'd be five of us setting out on this trip, and if this was a trip that I insisted the family go on and then something went wrong, everybody could blame me. It was my fault.
Dad's fault.
Right. But if instead the group had agreed together about it, then I think it was everyone's fault.
David, let's turn to a topic again that particularly is preoccupying this democracy at this time. We have been in a wrestling match, in some cases a mud wrestling match, over the issue of abortion, especially
Yes.
for the last 5 or 6 years. There is a medically complicating issue in terms of morals and ethics, and that is the discovery that fetal tissue transplantation may be very useful.
Yes.
Describe how it's useful, and is it in potential or actually useful at this point?
It's potentially useful, I think we have to say. The reason fetal tissue, there's two reasons this issue becomes very acute. One is that fetal tissue is, in the jargon, immunologically naive. That mm-hmm. is to say, a fetus within its mother's uterus is actually a foreign body. It's a whole new separate organism. And if it's not going to be rejected the way people reject other transplanted organs, fetal tissue has to have this special characteristic, meaning it doesn't trigger the rejection response. So that makes fetal tissue a very strong candidate for transplantation.
It can just slide in and stay there.
That's right. Oh. That's right. Now, there are immunosuppressive drugs that can be used with adult tissue, but those drugs have powerful side effects, and they're very expensive, so that the use of the fetal tissue would be extremely convenient. Secondly, to make the system work, you almost have to use tissue from induced abortions, let's say from elective or chosen abortions, because for a couple of reasons. One is that the tissue taken as a result of a spontaneous abortion is seldom put into a sterile and clean environment. That's unsurprising given the circumstances in which a spontaneous abortion would occur. Moreover, a large fraction, not all, but a large fraction of spontaneous abortions are the result of disease or defect in the fetus, which obviously compromises the fetal tissue as a source of transplantation. A hard issue on which reasonable persons will disagree is how tightly these two issues, the abortion issue on the one hand and the fetal tissue issue on the other, should be yoked together.
If we go back to the question of moral issues relative to Nazi experimentation, there will be people who, about the issue of fetal transplantation, will simply say, shun it.
Yes.
It must not be ever done.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I think that's an understandable view. I myself, I suppose I adopt a middle-of-the-road position on abortion. I think that some abortions that are done are moral and some that are immoral. I mean, I don't think you can make a sweeping blanket judgment. But I think some of them are immoral. And so I think the use of the fetal tissue does raise a significant issue. I don't think that that can be trivialized. But it's not, I myself would not draw the inference that we can't use the tissue. I want to draw the inference that use of the tissue must not encourage abortions. It must not, you don't want people getting pregnant in order to abort, in order to give tissue. We need some safeguards against things like that. But after that has been said, I think use of the tissue is analogous to use of other human products we get as a result of tragedy. The body of someone killed in an automobile accident, the body of a murder victim. Those are, or may be, products that are tainted, that we have as the result of a serious human moral failing. But we don't, in those cases, draw the inference that we can't use the product. And I don't think we should in this case either. I want us using it reverentially. I don't want us using it in a way that suggests abortion is just like amputation or not an unusually ambiguous procedure. I think it is an ambiguous procedure. But I want us to be able to use the tissue. I think it's, as with the Nazi data, I think the strategy of shunning, of complete isolation or walling off, ultimately amounts to a denial of reality and an attempt to keep a self purer than it really can be. It's kind of a denial of the ambiguity of all life, I think.
Around the issue of not encouraging a mother or potential mother to get pregnant in order to have an abortion,
yes,
in order to give the tissue of the fetus up for research, are there not safeguards in place at this point?
Oh,
so you cannot sell that product?
Absolutely. Safeguards of several kinds. First, there's a requirement of anonymity. You can't specify who's going to get it.
My Uncle Charlie.
Secondly, there's a requirement of no payment. You can't be paid for it. So that there's a whole... It's very clear right now that people can't abort with the idea of... can't conceive and then abort with the idea of providing tissue, either for personal gain or more altruistically to help somebody out.
And that's also true for the surgeon, for the...
Yes, that's right. There's a requirement that they be separate medical teams or staffs, so that the group that does the abortion must be separated from the group that would do the tissue transplantation. Moreover, the request for use of the tissue must come after the abortion decision has been made. It can't be used as an inducement. It can only be asked The question can only be asked after the abortion question has been settled. I might add, by the way, that what's the current state of policy on this issue in the United States today is as follows. A major federal panel recommended using the tissue with these safeguards, but the administration has nevertheless placed a moratorium on any federal funding for research using human fetal tissue. The result is that there is some experimentation done using human fetal tissue, but it's privately funded, it's clandestine, and it's unregulated. And I find that to be, as one medical ethicist put it, a sleazy and scummy situation. I mean,
by hiding our heads in the sand.
Exactly, by hiding our heads in the sand, we're allowing a very abusive, kind of potentially very abusive, let me say, situation to go on. And I think that's just terrible. I think it'd be much better to acknowledge it as a reality, to regulate it, and to make sure that it was only used for projects that were of genuine scientific merit. And when the review system is, or when the experimentation is taken out of the kind of review, peer review, and IRB safeguards that are in place for federally funded research, a lot of protection is lost.
Let's get to what I think of as the hardest part of the issue. The abortion debate is one that breaks down to you're wrong, I'm right, you're immoral, and I'm enlightened. It doesn't matter whose side. Both sides seem to say that about the other. Is there any way in this nation at this time that we can find some sort of common ground on which to stand in order to begin debating this in the open, at least to the point where the government might feel comfortable enough to open up research again?
I think it's going to be slow. There's been some wonderful studies of the abortion debate. I think one in particular done by a sociologist at some point associated with the University of California, Berkeley, named Kristen Luker. And Luker's research just shows how views on abortion are a reflection of very different kinds of socioeconomic and personal backgrounds, and that there's dissonance, and the dissonance is not just, or maybe not even primarily, between women and men. It's among women over the issue. And my observation is that the public debate has tended to become one strictly of posturing. I don't think we're going to get out of that very fast. My own view is that the only way around that problem is for much more honest, serious, and reflective discussion that is, in a certain sense, private, or at least that isn't done under the spotlights, but where people can be interrogative. There's a very interesting book by Daniel and Sidney Callahan, a husband and wife team who, Dan Callahan was the founding father of the Hastings Center, this great think tank in New York. Sidney is his wife. They themselves, as a couple, take differing views on the abortion issue. He is liberal, she is conservative. And they pulled together a group of people who would, all women, I believe, who would reflect about this question and share their differing perspectives. And one thing that was very striking was that there was, in fact, some middle ground. I mean, very few people really think that any abortion decision, anytime somebody chooses for abortion, therefore it's right. Almost everybody will admit that sometimes when a woman chooses abortion, she's making a mistake. They may disagree about what those times are, but they acknowledge that there is such a group of cases. On the other hand, there's also very few people who really say absolutely no abortions ever. No matter how bad the fetal defect, no matter how bad the woman's economic circumstances, no matter how serious the risk to the woman's life, so that, in fact, we can, if we go off stage, we start talking to each other seriously and taking a little time, we can narrow the areas of disagreement considerably, I think, even on the abortion issue. And I agree with you that the abortion issue is the issue on which the disagreement has been the most intense. Mm-hmm. Really throughout my professional lifetime, certainly for the past 15 years.
Once again, you're listening to Conversations, and my guest today, I'm Susan McGinnis, my guest today is Dr. David Smith. We are very grateful to Dr. Smith today for bringing himself to the conversational chair. His health is difficult and complicated. There is a major cold, which you can tell in his voice. To reintroduce in another way Dr. Smith to you, he has written extensively on medical ethics, on relationships between physician, patient, on suicide, death, and caring for the dying, on abortion, and on research on human subjects, all articles relating to medical ethics, other articles as well we'll take a look at in a few minutes. Are there particular institutions, Dr. Smith, in which you believe this discussion should commence and continue? We can't do it under lights. We can't really do it in magazines and newspapers anymore. Mm-hmm. Where should we, if we're going to quiet about it?
I think of three contexts for sure. One is educational. I think that it's a tragedy that our educational institutions, both secondary and especially higher education, don't provide more opportunity and guidance and help and support and training in discussion about fundamental, difficult issues. I think that's important, I should say, not only in higher education, but in secondary education. And and one of the reasons we don't is that a lot of faculty, secondary school, and college or university faculty don't feel comfortable talking about the issues. And I think that reflects a serious problem in our training of secondary school teachers and in our training of university faculty. I think we're paying the price for decades of buying the positivist vision of education, which essentially was education is simply about learning facts and skills. Education is not in any legitimate way about values. The only way values might get in is in terms of so-called values clarification, in the notion that you can argue about values. Mm-hmm. Was treated as just grotesque. I think that's no longer a credible view. I think that for at least one reason, there's a whole range of them, but one reason it's no longer a credible view is that we've discovered you just can't lead a life without coming to some value conclusions, without wrestling with those kinds of issues. And I think that a lot of us who are involved with university and faculty affairs think that we want our students to hit young adulthood a little better prepared for that kind of thinking and reflection than we were 30 years ago. But I don't think that educational institutions are the only place. One other place that I think is very important is religious communities. I happen to be a active churchgoer. And my observation is that in adult Sunday school classes and other places, adult human beings are very eager for a context in which to talk about this issue. In learning a new slant, in helping them come to terms with the issue. But I think, in fact, that happens very seldom. Mm-hmm. I think that religious communities like the educational establishment tends to say, let's not rock the boat. Let's not get into this.
And to talk about it is to rock it.
Oh, yeah. Sure. It's disconcerting to talk about it, mm-hmm. to discover that there are persons in the congregation who really disagree with you. Mm-hmm. That's discomfort making. I would add that I think there are other community contexts, for instance, service organizations like Rotary or some other places, where people ought to be getting practice in moral argument and not just living with and surrounding themselves with people with whom they already agree.
You have presented seminars and workshops and directed grants for bringing the discussion of ethics, moral issues to the corporate world and to service organizations. Have you found them receptive?
Entirely. Absolutely. They're hungry for it. I mean, the old joke has it is education is too good to be wasted on the young. And that's vividly true with education about moral matters. Now, no adult is pleased to have some pointy-headed academic come in and announce to him that everything he's been doing is immoral.
Right.
That's grotesque. But as academics, we do have at our disposal some distinctions, some characteristic visions of the world, some other things that we can share with people and that they can fold in to their way of doing business, to their mode of life. And I would add that I think academics have a tremendous amount to learn in that exchange. Mm-hmm. Tremendous amount to learn.
I want to take a turn here. Another issue that we struggle with, it is a medical issue and it is a moral issue in this country, is HIV infection and the diseases associated with AIDS. I think as a nation have had a terrible time grappling with AIDS because when we first began to hear about it and learn a little bit about it, it was associated with either a very small population, hemophiliacs, or people we either didn't trust for one reason or another or didn't like, homosexuals, IV drug users, and unfortunately Haitians also in that group. I think all four were rather beleaguered.
Yes.
At the end of the 20th century, are we coping any better with the HIV virus as a moral and a medical issue than we were when we first began to hear about it at the beginning of the 80s?
That's a tough question. I guess I do think, on balance, we are coping a little better. At least, even in a state like Indiana, which is a very conservative state, not a particularly progressive state, there is a advisory group in the public health, in the Department of Public Health, very concerned with confidentiality, fair treatment, equal access to resources, and so forth. So I think, as opposed to what might have happened, let's say, 25 years ago, I think probably we are doing a little better. Now, that said, I think there are tremendous problems. And you see one of them right now with this great pressure to require testing of healthcare professionals, dentists, physicians, and so on and so forth. I myself think that's a terrible mistake. The likelihood of transmission of the virus from healthcare professionals to patients is so minute as to be scarcely calculable. The only case that has any remote degree of credibility is the Bregalis case in Florida, and it's entirely unclear how, in fact, she got it. I mean, there's one possibility, very real possibility, is that her physician, Dr. Aker, I believe his name was, in fact, was not using universal precautions, and that she picked it up from his instruments. One doesn't know, and I don't mean to be kind of righteously judging all that from outside. I just think that it's that there is a kind of terror associated with this, and we lose all sense of perspective. The attitude of me dying while under an anesthetic for surgery is much greater than it is of me picking up the AIDS virus from somebody else. And as people have said repeatedly over the past, well, throughout the duration of the epidemic, but certainly for the past 5 or 6 years, the chances of picking up hepatitis B are also much greater than they are picking up HIV. I must say, however, that I'd add one twist to this. That is, I have heard physicians say that no, we shouldn't have to be tested, but on the other hand, we do want our patients tested before we operate on them. And I feel that's just out of court. I mean, I think you can't have it both ways. And that's really one of the reasons I want to insist on the universal precautions and on the right of everybody to avoid, I don't want any compulsory testing, because I'm pretty convinced that once we get into compulsory testing, we're going to be really, or we're going to be perceived to be limiting and reducing services to persons in very great need. And I think that's unacceptable.
There is one more issue associated with AIDS that may have implications beyond those suffering from HIV, and that is that we have in this country such strict safeguards relative to when drugs may be released for use, that there are drugs, it is felt anyway, that are far enough along in experimentation that could actually help people who are dying, but are being withheld from people who are, as they charge, dying anyway. What's your sense relative to that issue?
I have to say that's not a subject I know much about. But I think there's also dangers the other way. That's to say, of the rewards for producing a therapy that can keep someone alive or cure some chronic problem. Those rewards, in terms of status, prestige, and money, are so overwhelming that there's a real pressure on physician researchers to announce they've got the cure, to break the scientific protocol, and to go public prematurely. And in the long run, that doesn't help anybody. So that I guess I am sort of, as I've said, this is an issue about which I know little. But I would enter my process of finding out more about the issue with a little bit of a bias in favor of the FDA and a restrictive policy on drug access, I think.
Certainly danger on both sides.
Yes.
Once again, this is Conversations. We're listening to Dr. David Smith. We have, at the end of this century, in metropolitan areas, tremendously overcrowded hospitals. The AIDS crisis has added to that in a major way. I have certainly read about and heard of hospitals, doctors who are saying, we simply can't provide care. It's beginning to fall on both age and economic lines, so that the elderly and poor people who are not well insured,
yes,
are getting less service when they could be getting more. Are we at a point in time where we are going to have a financial and an ethical crunch in this country?
I think so. I mean, I'm very persuaded by the arguments made by Dan Callahan and others that suggest that our increasing rate of growth of expenditure in healthcare just can't go on forever. I think it's a bad mistake to say that the goal of healthcare is a world in which people never died or lived to be 100 or 110 or 120. I think that there is, as the Bible says, a time to be born and a time to die, and that the best life is in fact a finite and limited life. Now, there are problems of overcrowding in some metropolitan areas. There's also a tremendous problem of excess bed capacity. There are hospitals that are not full, and physicians who aren't adequately employed in taking care of physicians. We're not under-doctored. We're not under-hospitaled. What we are is very inefficient in terms of our placement of hospitals and our placement of doctors. And one of the reasons for that is so much of our decision-making in this context is a product of strictly free market. I don't know about Alaska. I wouldn't be too surprised to discover there's a physician shortage in Alaska. There's no physician shortage in suburban New York or suburban Chicago. There is physician shortage in the ghetto. Physicians are free to practice where they want to practice. People are free to set up hospitals where they will make money and where the working conditions for physicians will be good. Mm. So I think rather than thinking about a surplus, we need to think of issues of misallocation and kind of lack of distribution according to need of healthcare resources.
What's the answer? Some sort of barefoot doctor, Peace Corps for the United States?
Well, it may be. I'm not fully conversant with what all the options might be. I am one of those who's very taken with the Canadian system, which allows more planning, construction of hospitals where they're needed, some incentives for physicians to locate in otherwise undesirable locations. I myself am not persuaded that the right answer is a national health service on the British model. I think that system would save us money. There's no doubt about that. We spend about twice the percentage of gross national product on healthcare that the English do. On the other hand, and I should say it before I get to the other hand, they provide, on the whole, a much better system of coverage of basic health care needs for the whole population. On the other hand, their system has tremendous problems. As you've graciously mentioned, that I'm struggling with a little bug. When I was in England, I will never forget seeing a high school teacher who in effect had my problem chronically. He had nasal polyps, and the result of those polyps was that his voice sounded ghastly. They could be removed relatively simply by elective surgery. In the United States, they'd been out within a month. When I saw him, this man had been in the waiting line for 2 years, and he was likely to wait still longer because it was never an emergency. There were always people more needy than he was. And I think there are those kinds of problems. I think we should change carefully, but I do think we should change.
Dr. Smith, I want to thank you for an interesting hour. You've been listening to Conversations here on KUAC-FM. We've been talking with Dr. David Smith. He is professor of religious studies at the University of Indiana and director of the Poynter Center for the Study of Ethics and American Institutions. Today on Conversations, we've been taking a look at medical ethics at the end of the 20th century. Thank you, David.
Thank you.